Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Well, we thought this would be a slow news week with only one big earnings report scheduled. We were wrong, and if you're here, you probably know what we're talking about. We'll get to the big Amazon Whole Foods deal in just a second, but first, we remind you that this episode of the Retail Focus Podcast is brought to you by Third Wave Water and ThirdWaveWater.com. The coffee you make at home isn't as good as the coffee you get when you go out to your favorite coffee shop. Well, Third Wave Water has the secret, and you can put it in your cup for less than 10 cents per cup of coffee. Visit them at ThirdWaveWater.com. Use the promo code FOCUS for 10% off your first order. Amazon set fire to retail news pundits on Friday, June 16th. They entered into an agreement to purchase Whole Foods Market in a deal worth $13.7 billion. And of course, the internet was rife with people with the hot takes on this. And we'll get to our takes on this deal in a second. But let's go through the deal details first, as this was announced pre-trading on Friday. Leighton, this might be the biggest retail deal of the year.
It is $13.7 billion. That figure includes debt, and it's going to be an all-cash deal and reflects a 27% premium to the share price prior to the announcement. Shares were up actually this year, trading around $35 to $36 per share. This deal was significant enough that Whole Foods shares were actually halted in trading on Friday morning at $32.77. And the funny thing is, despite the deal tanking every other retail stock in that particular grocery sector, Amazon was up 0.5% in early trading on Friday. After the resuming of trading, Whole Foods shares went up to $41.99, which is reflective of the purchase price. They ended on Friday a little bit above the $42 a share mark. Both companies said Whole Foods would retain their board and their leadership group, and this was a focal point over the past 6 months, as we both know that they had a co-CEO setup. And John Mackey ended up taking the helm as the full-time CEO. And so this deal will result in John Mackey staying on as the full-time Whole Foods CEO. After all, he has been with the business since they were founded. And you look at the company's headquarters, they will also stay in Austin. The deal is expected to close sometime during the second half of 2017. Obviously, this deal is going to be extremely complex, as Whole Foods has several partnerships throughout the United States. And then obviously, Amazon is just now getting into this space. We talk about their bookstores and their presence with online grocery delivery. But this is going to be a fascinating setup because there's a lot of synergies here and the impacts vary widely. We see every grocery stock was down, as mentioned early in trading Friday, including Target, Kroger, Weiss, and so forth. And you see that Target was down about $3 per share, and that's where they ended up for the day. But Target's interesting because they don't all have groceries, obviously, but Walmart and Target are considered in the group of grocers in the United States. Kroger was also interesting to me, Trent, because we're going to talk about them a little bit later on in this podcast, but they were down because of earnings. And they were down even more significantly. And this after analysts saying that what they were initially down Thursday was a buy point. So very interesting news. Shockwaves throughout the grocery industry. Kroger's stock fell as much as 15% before leveling off around $22 a share.
When you look at some of the other markets that were down, you mentioned Wise Markets. They were down 8% to around $46.84 per share in early market trading. Right after the announcement, Super Value took the biggest hit. They were down 16% to $3.15. This despite the fact that Super Value has been pretty transparent about getting out of the brick and mortar grocery game, gradually trying to move their business towards distributorships. Sysco, even the food distributor, was down 5.2% to $42.65. Perhaps some people on the market thinking that this could also hurt food distributors as well, given Amazon's size. Sprouts Farmers Market, you would guess, would be down in this case, and they were. They were down 13.5% to $19.40. This is over $3 down. And even Walmart, who were boosted somewhat by their own acquisition talk, we'll talk about that later on in the show, they fell 6.4%, or about $5, to $73.87. One of the interesting things about this, among many interesting things, is that earlier this week, it was announced that Amazon had patented a technology that would prevent people from using in-store Wi-Fi to price check items at other retailers. A lot of people were left scratching their heads, wondering why that technology was necessary for Amazon, since their brick-and-mortar holdings relatively few and far between. Some thought that it was simply a way to get out in front of the technology before other retailers, perhaps department stores, Walmart, even began using the same thing. Some figured that they were getting ready to boost their brick-and-mortar base. Turns out that that one was the case. Now, whether or not they patented the technology because of the boost in brick-and-mortar base, that remains to be seen. The patent also mentioned their ability to upsell or suggest goods based on Wi-Fi store location, so this was also a proposed use and might come in play as they begin to operate Whole Foods Market. But I think my biggest takeaway from today and from everything that's happened and all the pundits, all the analysts talking about this deal, even those that don't necessarily know a whole lot about the retail sector, is just that the market and the populace is very, very reactionary. So if we go back and look at the true meaning of this deal, yes, it means that Amazon now has over 460 brick-and-mortar locations. They might be able to unlock some synergies there. Yes, it means that Whole Foods gets certainly financial stability from a larger operator in Amazon. But you look at the wide-ranging impacts on other companies' stock prices. As Leighton mentioned, after earnings Thursday, where Kroger had same-store sales fall just 0.2%, their stock plummeted. We'll talk about that in the next story. They were considered at a buy point for many analysts, and then their stock plummets again. And I think when you look at this deal and you look at Kroger as a company, it's very difficult to find a justification for tanking Kroger stock further. Now, I should mention I own just one vanity share in Kroger, just so I get investor information and that type of thing from them, invites to their shareholders day, that type of thing. So I don't have large holdings in Kroger. And I should mention that before I go on this mini rant. First, Kroger is more profitable on a bottom line margin basis than Amazon to begin with, because Amazon focuses so much on price and the delivery services. Kroger actually shows on a margin basis a better profit on their bottom line than Amazon. Do they make as much money? No, they're not as large in terms of their annual revenue as Amazon, but they turn more of their revenue into profit than does Amazon, and there's no expectation that that's not going to continue. Another facet is that Kroger's last mile programs and partnerships are already well established. I keep seeing analysts say that brick-and-mortar grocers have had trouble with these last-mile services. When we talk about Kroger's partnership both with Shipt and also creating their own clickless programs, they have been extraordinarily well-received in the markets they've rolled those out in. They also have over five times the brick-and-mortar locations as Whole Foods Market and a far more established distribution network for perishables than does Whole Foods. And that's something that people seem to be ignoring about this deal. They'll either talk about Amazon being able to tap into Whole Foods' perishable network or Whole Foods able to tap into Amazon's distribution network, but they forget that a store like Kroger or even an operator like Albertsons and Safeway, they have a far greater distribution network already set up for perishables than does either Whole Foods or Amazon. Kroger also beat both Amazon's existing grocery offerings and Whole Foods Market on price across the board. When you look at Whole Foods Market, you see a business that's really operating in a premium spot in the marketplace, not only with organics, but also with pricing. The same organic product at a Whole Foods Market will be about 20 to 25% less expensive at a Kroger or even a Walmart. And this is where I disagree with other analysts. I looked at Stifel's Mark Astrachan and his take on this deal, and he said, and I quote, "We anticipate Amazon's ownership is likely to result in lower prices at Whole Foods, forcing other grocery participants to follow, negatively impacting category margins. And I would agree with this if Whole Foods were at all in the same ballpark in terms of price as Kroger. I think the only business that has to worry at this price point is honestly Sprouts or perhaps the Fresh Market. I think generally Kroger, Walmart, they are going to be safe from price competition because they've already been having their current price war, and Whole Foods was left in the dust a long time ago on that deal. So that's where I disagree with him on this, is that I don't feel like Kroger or a lot of the other grocers that we mentioned, particularly Walmart, are going to be affected too much by the dropping prices. And honestly, what good does it do Amazon as a whole if they drop prices to win over consumers at the cost of bottom line margins? If you're okay with losing money at Whole Foods Market, that's one thing, but it's not going to be a sustainable business practice over the long term. And oh, by the way, we should mention regarding Kroger, they outpaced the grocery industry as a whole in same-store sales, far outpacing Whole Foods Market. And Leighton, honestly, I doubt Amazon's ability to increase traffic at Whole Foods Market just by taking them over. They have to make some strategic changes going ahead.
Amazon is a long-term company, so you would have to imagine that they are seeing long-term prospects for this acquisition of Whole Foods Market. But Trent, you are correct in saying that this is a very reactionary stance from shareholders and the other companies that really are seeing this deal as a potential threat to the grocery industry. And to put all of this in perspective, we're talking about a $13.7 billion deal, and that's around the market cap now where Whole Foods sits since the stock price went up. If you compare that to Kroger, which we are comparing within this story, they have a $16.5 billion market cap. This is a grocer with over 2,800 locations, is the consensus number two grocer in the United States. And if you compare that to Whole Foods unit count, they have 431 stores throughout the United States and have been seeing same store sales fall low single digits. So I think right here, this really speaks to the larger picture surrounding the story. And that I think right here, it's not just that Amazon may be overpaid or is there long-term value to be extracted outside of this deal, but it's more of the immediate implications in the stock price and how shareholders can overreact. So I'm sure those same analysts that were saying Kroger was a buy after they released those earnings are definitely saying it now.
And it's not to say that I think it's a bad deal. I think it's a good idea by Amazon, especially at this price point, to go ahead and purchase Whole Foods. It does give them a brick and mortar stance. My only concern is that I don't feel it's the massive threat to the grocery industry. We've seen so many headlines today about Kroger better watch out for Whole Foods or Aldi better watch out for Whole Foods. The reality of it is those companies have been eating Whole Foods' lunch for a good time now. And I think the reactionary nature of the grocery industry today is reflective of the reactionary nature of the market as a whole with anything regarding Amazon. We'll recall the Amazon Go initiative. That concept never really got off the ground, but it's funny because people today are mentioning it like it was an actual thing that happened and had massive success and ate into market share. But people that don't follow retail didn't know that that concept, A, didn't really work out, and B, it's more of a competition to convenience stores. And as I mentioned earlier, Whole Foods Market struggling mightily with traffic. Amazon will have to cut prices, which means cutting margins to get people in through the door. But the bottom line is, if you believe that grocers will actually be impacted to the level where Kroger's market cap had fallen, and Kroger lost about a third of their market cap in the last 2 days, you're probably also the same person that bought into the Amazon Go concept when they released that completely. Things are very slow to change. Almost glacial in the grocery industry to change. And are we seeing change? Yes. But the reality of it is Kroger has been able to keep up more than any other grocer with some of this change. And you look at even other grocers in this system. Meijer, of course, which we'll talk about later on in the show, is a private company, but you can bet if they were traded on the stock market, their stock would have fallen. Walmart's done a great job with keeping up with the grocery industry and, of course, acquired Jet.com. They have far greater distribution networks when it comes to perishables than Amazon, and yet their price still fell by a significant margin. in all, we need to kind of pump our brakes here. Remember that there are established industry leaders that are ahead of both Whole Foods Market and Amazon currently in the grocery space. And also we need to remember that a good chunk of consumers either couldn't afford Whole Foods Market or were price conscious in the first place. And I think when I mentioned that analyst from Stifel earlier, he's kind of ignoring the fact that Amazon has already been charging a premium with their Fresh program such that price conscious consumers probably weren't buying groceries through them in the first place. That's the main barricade that they have to take down. And now with Lidl entering the United States and opening some of their first locations this month in the U.S., I think that's something they've got to keep in mind as well. Not that I'm saying that Amazon and Whole Foods are going to fail in this deal. I think the deal will work out. I just don't think it's going to rob market share from other grocers to the exact same extent. And I would encourage certainly moderation in thought going forward regarding the grocery industry. And I certainly don't think, as some analysts have stated, that brick and mortar grocery is in imminent danger of demise.
Well, speaking of Kroger, they released those earnings we discussed on Thursday morning, giving us some insight into the progress on food prices and the inflationary measures inside the United States. The results were for their first fiscal quarter, and the market really did react to this. As we mentioned, the grocery powerhouse had a solid quarter, but analysts were hung up on the big cuts in their full-year earnings per share guidance, as the renewed guidance and outlook was about 20 to 25% below average analyst estimates. The results for the quarter, speaking of financials, earnings came in at $303 million or 32 cents per diluted share, down 56.5% from last year. Adjusted earnings per share were 58 cents, excluding the impacts of charges for the withdrawal liability in their voluntary retirement offering and pension funds. We mentioned that earlier this year. A lot of those long-tenured workers were offered a sort of exit package, a 18.3% drop over last year's adjusted earnings per share. This was actually a beat by 1 cent over Zacks' consensus estimates. Revenue was also a beat on Wall Street expectations. Top-line growth of nearly 4.9% caused the retailer to bring in $36.29 billion. Analysts were expecting $35.46 billion. And you see that same-store sales, as you had mentioned in the previous story, Trent, did fall modestly, but just by 0.2%, excluding the impacts of fuel. Same-store sales were a focal point from analysts as they were pointing to the increased competition from Aldi. You mentioned Lidl's expansion throughout the United States and Walmart's pricing structure with groceries over the past several quarters and onward. Aldi just announced plans to invest another $5 billion in their U.S. presence, meaning a growth of approximately 900 locations throughout, and plus the continued existing portfolio investment. You're talking about infrastructure there and remodeling some of their continued store base. And you see Lidl just opened their first 10 stores on Thursday of this week in Virginia and North and South Carolina. And Walmart has expanded their grocery pickup programs and has even suggested associate delivery at their most recent investor day. And Trent, you highlighted some very good points from that and how that would work as far as the functionality was concerned and the logistics there. But same-store sales were largely a function of falling commodity prices as oversupply has hit several segments. We have recently discussed the recently low egg prices due to no big safety issues hitting those markets. Also, the lack of demand in the beef industry has caused those prices to either fall or remain somewhat stable. And one of the reasons we dug into Tyson's quarter is to really look and see into the protein business, how that dynamic is working. And we really are seeing a lack of demand as consumers are changing their preferences. An interesting side note, in their May 2017 release of their Independent Grocers Financial Survey, the National Grocers Association reported sales being down 1.62% for grocers in 2016 versus 2015. So if you look at these numbers and compare to Kroger's performance, you see that they're actually outperforming in the industry as a whole, an industry that CEO Rodney McMullen said was a $1.5 trillion market. And Trent, this is interesting because Jim Cramer had come out yesterday after the Kroger earnings report and said this is really showing how the grocery industry overall is like the retail industry and that you're seeing falling sales. But actually, both of these are completely false because both of these markets are growing year over year.
generally what you've seen, though, is price deflation for groceries. And again, a lot of macroeconomic analysts feel like grocery inflation will take place at the end of this year, at the beginning of next. We mentioned in the preview to this story last week, we'd get a barometer on where it's going. And for Kroger, it is just slightly down because of that decrease by 0.2% in terms of same-store sales. They mentioned traffic relatively stable at Kroger, but it is the basket size that is cutting in just slightly to the same-store sales. Now, at the same time, it looks like that grocery deflation starting to level out a little bit. And I think that's what Jim Cramer, although he gets paid for viewers and that type of thing, groceries are more of a commodity because they're a necessity. You can't compare it to, say, a fashion retailer, because oftentimes you're looking at something that's not a requirement for a household to purchase. But in the case of groceries, groceries are more or less a requirement for most households in the United States. And that's why pricing is so important here. If you see grocery inflation, then grocery stores will bounce right back up in terms of same store sales. It's not just like people are going to eat less. And certainly we're seeing in the restaurant industry, a lot more people are going towards smaller fast casual chains than some of the larger and more traditional FSRs. So you're really seeing price competition there as well. Speaking of pricing, management said they, and I quote, refuse to lose on pricing. Leighton and I both live in different towns. We were kind of comparing pricing based on the Kroger stores we live nearby. My Kroger store that I'm nearby is pretty consistently cheaper than Walmart, whereas Leighton, his is kind of the other way around. But his, Dylan's, is competitive with Sprouts, Whole Foods, Natural Grocers, and the like. Later in the Q&A session where management talked about pricing, they also said they don't want the refusing to lose on price, quote, to be overplayed. You get the sense that they got worried a little bit about how analysts were taking the pricing strategy, worried about eroding margins and that type of thing. Although, as it turns out, the stock price decreased enough to where I'm not sure they had to worry about analysts' worry. During the last earnings call, prior to this one, management echoed what many in the restaurant space have talked about, saying they expect prices to increase towards the end of the calendar year. And while inflation has ticked up in most other areas, it's actually a little bit below the Fed's target, and inflation hasn't ticked up at all in terms of groceries. Gasoline prices continuing to be fairly low, and strong production yields in areas such as wheat are helping to keep grocery prices low. Gasoline, of course, affecting the transportation of the items to market in the grocery sector. Management has made remarks in the past about how 2-3% inflation would be perfect for them, but admitted they are rarely up against those perfect conditions. And here in this last quarter, certainly a perfect conditions for Kroger's deflation was a factor. They mentioned they saw a 20 basis point reduction, a very slight but still a reduction in the prices for goods, and they're still experiencing year-over-year deflation to this point for the company. As just one example of why prices are falling, Kansas wheat, for example, one of the largest wheat-producing states in the nation, is set to have their largest production year ever. But the problem is, for farmers at least, they're complaining about the relatively low wheat prices, and in turn, Kroger will then get goods sold to them at a lower price, but because of the price wars, have to essentially sell that to the consumer at a low price. So it's an interesting dynamic when things are actually going so smoothly, everyone is outperforming, you just don't get quite as much money for their goods.
You're absolutely right, Trent. So it's interesting because of the heightened supply, you actually see prices decrease. So it's kind of an interesting dynamic when you have to factor in the idea that both the farmers and the operators of grocery stores are going to be affected in different ways. Well, if we look through the conference call statements, you can see that Kroger as a company, they seem very bullish on the idea of pursuing their long-term goals. They said the earnings per share outlook, it's just a short-term hit, and they're really focused on returning increased dividends to shareholders and continuing on with those buybacks that they've been doing over the past four quarters. They offered acknowledgement with regards to the big changes in food retail overall, both operationally, how they operate individual stores, and from the competition standpoint, where there's more players in the space and they have to be more price competitive, as you mentioned, Trent. But management said that investment in the short term would lead to these longer term values within the company. And this is nice because reading through statements that they made in the first quarter of 2016, they are consistently following through on their reinvestment strategy within the company. And because of this, you see the results really paying off here. 30% growth in new digital customers, and that led to conversion with 30% increase in digital sales as a result. And last year, looking through that conference call, they listed 25 markets in which they had the ClickList platform and the Express Lane platform. And you see, this looks to be over 30 now. So they're really trying to drive their omni-channel networks. And if you look through a statement in the company, they said that we are driving strategy of lowering costs to reinvest in ways that provide the right value to our customers. We are pleased that identical supermarket sales in the last 9 weeks of the first quarter were positive, and that has continued in the second quarter to date. And they want to create the right value proposition, and this includes having fresh foods at low prices every single day. And if you think back, this really does sound familiar to Walmart's pricing strategy of everyday low prices, the campaign that they had for a very long time. And you also look at their private label initiatives, which tie right into the pricing concept of keeping prices low. They said private label in Kroger stores, all the different private label brands they have, now account for 28% of merchandise sold in terms of the units. However, 25.6% of sales, which is still very impressive and actually matches up to what they had around this time last year. Speaking of last year, the company said they were going to be okay as long as they were focused on the customer in terms of giving them great service. So obviously, being a very big brick and mortar retailer, even though they do have that omni-channel presence, in store wise, they are mentioning how they have this friendly service and they've actually hired more people to more functional areas of their store. And last year, I was reading through the notes on the conference call during 2016's earnings release, and you see that they hired around 12,000 people. They had actually had applications of over 100,000. And so management acknowledged really the balancing act between the price investment and the human capital investment. And they've added more of those people. And not only that, they've boosted wages. So they've mentioned wage growth overall. And they said this is to reduce turnover in the long term. So anytime you see decreased turnover rates, you're going to be seeing less expenditures overall. Obviously, it costs a lot of money to have people come aboard with training programs and the like, but they are trying to relegate cash into other areas of the business, and they are fighting back against companies like Blue Apron and other prepared meal services, something that you and I have brought up in the past, Trent, because these are companies that really have come into the digital space and are taking the idea away of going into your brick and mortar store late at night to get the foods you need to prepare a meal. And so because of this, they've begun piloting something called the Prep Plus Paired Meal Kits in their home of Cincinnati. And they said this is going to be restaurant quality meals that you can make in 20 minutes or less. And I think this is very smart. If they are able to advertise this correctly and have a good program to go along with it, now is the time to enter in something like this, because you see the companies like Blue Apron taking hold, but still in the long scheme of things, they are relatively young in the space.
Finally, and on the outlook for the company, we talked about how analysts after this earnings report said that they felt like a lot of Kroger shares were oversold. And that was at the time where shares are around $24 a share. They ended trading on Friday, June 16th at $22 per share. And that still seems to be some analyst sentiment, although other analysts, because of the Amazon and Whole Foods deal, seem to be bailing on Kroger. But management remains focused on returning value to the shareholders. Over this last year, they repurchased $1.5 billion in shares, and over $435 million was paid out in dividends to shareholders over the past year. Their dividend looking better all the time as their share price is going down. They're investing more than half of their capital back into their business. Full year earnings per share guided to be a bit lower than previously guided numbers. And I think that's where shares mostly fell, despite the fact that they beat analyst expectations on top line revenue and profit. The company now expects full year 2017 earnings per share in the range of $2 to $2.05 per share. That's down around 20 cents from where they had previously expected. As noted at the beginning of the story, analysts were expecting much better earnings for the full year, around $2.50 a share, on an average basis. So I think that's why you see the stock fall. Still, their price to earnings ratio currently sitting just above 10, which I think we both feel is somewhat low for a company that continues to grow through acquisition, continues to open up new stores, and isn't seeing as bad a same store sales hit as most other grocers are in this time of grocery deflation. We go back to Friday's merger and acquisitions news is within 30 minutes, both Amazon and Whole Foods and Walmart turned the retail world upside down a little bit. Walmart acquired men's fashion e-commerce giant Bonobos for $310 million, all of it in cash. This continues Walmart's string of acquisitions in e-commerce, with all the dominoes starting to fall first after they acquired Jet.com and Mark Lohr came over in that deal to take over as their e-commerce CEO. Leighton has the details of this.
Bonobos will be folded into Walmart's slew of online brands. And what's more, Andy Dunn, Bonobos founder and CEO, will come on board under Walmart's e-commerce CEO. Dunn will work under Mark Lohr to cultivate Walmart's increasing portfolio of digitally native vertical brands. And you see them acquiring a lot of brands over the past year, Trent. And this is a continuation of these acquisitions, and they're looking to be a little bit more useful to Walmart on the e-commerce side of things, with just few brick and mortar tie-ins mentioned for their prior acquisitions. You're seeing that Dunn will at the very least oversee ModCloth and Bonobos. Will other brands potentially be joining the mix in the future? No word yet on that, but the deal again is for $310 million in cash, subject to FTC approval, of course, and it's expected to close more quickly than the aforementioned Amazon Whole Foods Market deal, looking for closure at the end of the second quarter, which is rapidly approaching, or at the beginning of the third quarter. And Trent, when you really ask the question of why they're making this deal, there are some questions to be had as to why Bonobos is coming into the fold.
Walmart is constantly seeking to build their cadre up of brands that are born online. This might help them in two different ways, both with the consumer base they're inheriting, mostly younger, millennial, although that's sometimes an overgeneralization, but also in that these brands are usually, not always though, but usually more tapped into the fashions of the day versus a typically slow-moving brick-and-mortar giant. And if there's been one criticism of Walmart's fashions, or even Kmart's or Sears or JCPenney's fashion, is that they seem to be a little bit more behind the times, whereas Bonobos, one of those brands where a lot of YouTuber viewers hopping on, talking about some of their recent materials and recent designs. Additionally, Walmart touts the vertical integration of these companies because Bonobos does control just about every step of the process from design down through creation. This is interesting because Walmart's almost always worked with outside suppliers when possible, so it's intriguing to me that they're looking for vertical integration in the e-commerce companies they are acquiring. For those wondering where the Bonobos products will be marketed, at least for the time being, they want to put their line on Jet.com. You won't be seeing them in all likelihood in Walmart stores anytime soon. At least that much wasn't indicated by the company. They do mention later in the release regarding this deal, potentially including Bonobos products through other Walmart brands, but mostly internationally. Let's look at some of the more interesting comments in this release. Lohr, for himself, mentions creating a value proposition for the consumer, and by this, he means mostly value in terms of brand awareness and quality here, not in terms of pricing. For example, Bonobos products run higher than the bulk of Walmart's clothing products, $88, for example, for a short sleeve button-down shirt, much more expensive than the average price point at Walmart. Walmart also mentioned, for their own company's part, the customer value proposition. And again, this seems kind of out of place when you have a company in Bonobos that has a deal with a company like Nordstrom, which they appear to continue to hold in place despite the Walmart acquisition, to talk about a value proposition. That's something we usually attribute towards the off-price space in fashion. But again, they're talking more about brand and quality recognition. Lohr does mention innovation a lot in the release. This is something that Walmart has sorely needed in their e-commerce presence, and they've gotten it not only through Lohr and Jet.com, but through some of the other companies that they've acquired. acquired ModCloth being another. Dunn, meanwhile, for his part, the CEO and founder of Bonobos, outside the release itself, said that Lore and Jet.com being on board at Walmart is essentially why the deal happened in the first place, that there might have been some hesitation there if those two, between the person, Lore, and the company, Jet.com, had not been in the generalized Walmart corporation. Absent in this release is any mention of Bonobos fitting locations, which they call guide shops. They have dozens of these kind of pseudo brick and mortar locations nationwide. They're intended for men to come in and be measured to ensure a perfect fit. Staff then place the order on behalf of the customer, so it's relatively hands-off, at least from the customer's point of view. What is interesting, though, is that they still have a lack of sizes on their website, despite the fact that they say, and I quote, fit is fact on their website. For example, they don't even sell my size on their particular website. Anyhow, one would assume that these guide shops would remain, but they could potentially bring ModCloth into the fold at these locations. ModCloth, another one of those online digital native companies that Walmart has acquired. They currently have just one brick and mortar store and they do fitting there. That's in Austin, Texas. No other fitting specific shops throughout the country. It would seem on Walmart's behalf or on Jet.com's behalf to make for a good business practice to somehow connect the two and put these ModCloth fitting stations inside Bonobos fitting stations as well to try and advertise that, drive further consumer engagement. But again, time will tell and we shall see. Coming up, we'll talk Bridge Street Market. That's the new Meijer small store concept, about 3 to 6 times smaller than a typical Meijer that's being opened up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, as we'll be joined by Chandra Martinez, a retail reporter at MLive, to discuss it. Do you ever wonder why the coffee you make at home never tastes as good as the coffee you buy at a coffee shop? Well, to the listeners of the Retail Focus, here's the secret. Coffee shops spend thousands of dollars to make the perfect water for making coffee, and now for as little as 10 cents per cup, you can duplicate that magic at home.
Third Wave Water has a patent-pending formula of minerals that, when added to a gallon of distilled water, makes for coffee brewing magic. Recently at the U.S. Brewers Cup Championship, the first and second place finishers brewed their coffee with Third Wave Water.
Check out their website at thirdwavewater.com and use the promo code FOCUS for 10% off your first order. And to the retailers out there, they also do wholesale as well, so check that out. It's the wholesale tab on thirdwavewater.com. Well, earlier this month, the store Meijer unveiled branding plans for their new smaller footprint store in Grand Rapids, Michigan, very near their headquarters there in Western Michigan. And joining us on the Retail Focus to talk a little bit more about the store, what it means to Grand Rapids specifically, is Chandra Martinez. She's a retail reporter for MLive working out of the Grand Rapids office. First, Chandra, thanks so much for joining us here today on the Retail Focus.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, so we'll start with the very beginning. I know plans for this location announced back in June. They've recently released some of the branding for this location. As far as someone who has covered Meijer as long as you have, what are some of the things that will be different about this location other than just the smaller square footage versus a normal Meijer store?
I think it'll be very differently. If anything, it might be closer to the convenience store that Meijer has at their gas stations. From what I understand so far, it's just going to be mostly groceries. Meijer is really known for having a combination of groceries and general merchandise. And a lot of people don't know this, but Walmart was actually copied off of Meijer. Meijer was the pioneer of this format in the 60s. So this is a bit of a departure for Michigan's biggest retailer.
And you bring up something that's very interesting in that when Walmart was doing studies for their what became their hypermarts and their supercenters, they sent executives to Meijer and kind of staked it out a little bit. Do you get the sense that Meijer might be patterning this store off of maybe like the neighborhood market at Walmart or some of the smaller store locations in urban areas we're starting to see?
I don't know. That's something that we're not quite sure of what they're doing. They definitely, this seems like a one-off, almost a favor they are doing to Rockford Construction, their longtime builder of their stores, and they're helping Rockford out. Rockford is started by this guy named Mike Van Gessel, and he's from the west side of Grand Rapids where this store is going to go into. And he's behind this three-acre development with affordable housing, things like that. It's part of kind of revitalizing this part of Grand Rapids. And they really did need a grocery store in this three-acre development. And I think, you know, Mike said, who better to turn to than one of the best retailers in the business? And he called his friends at Meijer, and they agreed to help them out. You know, but the new branding does tell you that this is going to be a different type of store, a different type of environment.
And it does seem to be branding that's specific to this location. After all, they're including the name of the street in the new branding. But I wanted to ask you a question about just the downtown area of Grand Rapids in general. I had read in the past on M Live that downtown Grand Rapids had needed a grocery store for quite some time. This development just outside of the downtown development area, how much will this grocery store benefit those actually living in downtown Grand Rapids?
People expect that a lot of people will be going to this grocery store. There's some other little grocery stores kind of popping up in the downtown, but they're a little bit more gourmet. This is a lot larger store than any of those smaller shops kind of around downtown. So this is expected to meet a lot of people's needs. It's going to be about 40,000 square feet. And Meijer is very good at, you know, merchandising, getting very good quality produce. So it should be a success.
Now, you mentioned merchandising. I know you guys at M Live have had a chance to take a look at some of the artist renderings. Can you give our listeners an idea of what this location might look like?
The renderings don't show the inside of the store yet, but it's going to be at the corner of this kind of multi-floor development. And as far as I can see, it's going to be kind of prominent on the corner, so it's expected to bring in a lot of foot traffic.
You mentioned other grocery stores or smaller grocery stores a moment ago. I wanted to talk to you about something that we were actually talking about off the air, in that there's a perceived impact potentially for another grocery store that's in the area. I want to say Duthler's Family Foods, if I'm maybe pronouncing that correctly, but I know there's an existing grocery store there. What are some of the impacts or the worries from them about a grocery store coming in?
There is some criticism that this entire project got about $19 million in state tax breaks. And there's some criticism that Meijer has a big name and it was able to, you know, help the developer get some tax breaks for this project. And a little shop like Duthler's, who's been around for 20 years in this working class neighborhood, would be able to get that support, because tax breaks usually don't go for retail projects. So there's a little criticism. But I think the one thing to remember about Duthler's is it does serve a working class clientele. They have a little smaller produce section. They don't have a big wine section like Meijer does. Their wine bottles are less than $10. So definitely Meijer is going to offer a different experience than what Duthler's does.
One more question before we wrap it up, if only because, you know, Meijer, one of the largest privately owned companies in the country. We don't get a chance to talk about them too much on the Retail Focus podcast simply because they don't release a lot of information or financials to the public. But are there any other projects or any other special things that Meijer might have in the works that maybe retail followers throughout the rest of the country may not know about?
I think they're really excited about their home delivery service. They're rolling that out very strong this year. And they moved away from being an online grocer a few years ago. That didn't work for them. So collaborating with Shipt is allowing them to do grocery delivery and, I think, serve people. In a lot of ways, this little grocery store in downtown or west side of Grand Rapids may not be as important to downtown dwellers, because they can now order groceries online to have delivered through Shipt, which kind of works like an Uber, where you have these contract people go and do your shopping and then they deliver your groceries. So I think that's what Meijer's very excited about, is this home delivery service.
All right, Chandra Martinez, retail reporter with M Live. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Retail Focus.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Once again, we thank Chandra for joining us here on the Retail Focus. She did a great job, at least from a locals perspective or a Michigan perspective, unpacking that new store construct. Interesting thing is, doing a little bit of research about that, there is already a Bridge Street Market elsewhere, just not owned by Meijer. It's in Grants Pass, Oregon. This other Bridge Street Market, though, is more of a deli cafe, C-store sales there. No word on what may happen to the name for Meijer or for this store, if there's enough difference between the two to coexist, especially if, as Chandra indicated, this might be a one-off deal for Meijer, or if Meijer may plan on taking the concept larger. Maybe they'll attempt to work out a deal. They don't have any holdings in Oregon, of course, so no particular worries there. We continue this segment of the Retail Focus podcast by discussing Ascena Retail Group, as we did in our Retail Quick Scan on YouTube this week. They announced in an earnings call that they plan on closing hundreds of stores in the next 3 years. The news came from David Jaffe, the president and CEO, just after more tepid earnings were released. And then this week, we got more information about job losses as well. Let's discuss these things. First, we begin with Ascena Retail's store closures. A reminder, they operate multiple brands, Maurice's, Dress Barn, Ann Taylor, Lane Bryant, and Justice among them. They have 4,850 total brick-and-mortar locations across their brands, and now, Leighton, they might be looking at closing several of them after their same-store sales dropped during this last quarter.
And you have to dig into the reasons as to why they're looking to close some of their stores and reduce their overall portfolio. As previously guided, their comparable store sales dropped 8% across all of their banners. This guidance was updated a little more than a month ago as the group saw alarming spring sales trends. Unlike their fashion brethren, you see that overall they didn't really blame the soft February sales, or at least this wasn't a primary factor to blame. The largest same-store sales hit was the Maurice's brand, which is a very big namesake brand. Same-store sales, they were down 12%. No store in their group saw positive same-store sales, and that is alarming if you are a shareholder. Ann Taylor saw negative 7%, Dress Barn negative 8%, Loft negative 6%, Lane Bryant was down negative 11%, Catherine's down 6%, and Justice, the preteen retailer in a lot of indoor malls, down 6%. And the loss in comparable sales was attributed almost entirely to traffic declines. Another very worrisome sign for the company, as the company mentioned high single-digit to low double-digit traffic declines across the board. You see the closures trend. The closures are going to affect many stores, but they already did close 36 stores during the last quarter, only opening 8, so for net closures of around 28. This has all come after the company was very aggressive in attempting to enter new markets with detailed real estate information on their company page, and we love transparency, and we really like the fact that each store, each brand for them had a unique demographic mix and that they were attempting to approach them in a very strategic way. However, the problem seems to be at retaining the shopping tendencies of these demographics, always trying to identify what your core consumer wants. And that's going to be tricky because they offer all of these different types of banners that have a very wide and varied mix of customer. You see now they've taken down the direct real estate link on their website. The closures are taking place through what they call a fleet optimization program. Fancy terminology for downsizing. And Trent, they're looking to be closing based on several pieces of criteria.
That is correct, and something we went into detail on the Retail Scan on YouTube. First, they're looking for store comp sales outlooks of negative mid-single digit on a compound annual growth rate basis. Those stores would be at risk. The other thing they're looking at is how many of their sales at that particular store could be transferred to another Ascena store, whether that's another store concept or a store in the same brand, where 10 to 30% of the sales could actually be transferred to another Ascena store. Those stores may also be in danger of being in that program. Third, the cash-based net present value of the store. And this isn't something, Leighton, we talk a whole lot about, but basically, where they have stores with negative net present values, these are stores where they expect future investment costs. So the money it costs to both own the store and keep up the store, stock it with merchandise, to exceed potential revenue from that store. They're looking at pushing those stores into the optimization program. Now, there are a total of 667 stores in the optimization program. Important to note that not all of these stores will be closed. Some media has misreported this somewhat, saying that they're looking to close over 600 stores. That's not necessarily true. 268 of the stores will be classified as hard closed stores, where basically Ascena will exit all of those locations. However, another 399 stores are considered for close in this optimization program, but They're holding out depending on whether or not their lease agreement can be adjusted by the landlord to more favorable terms. This is in part because the stores in this program have a much higher occupancy rate in terms of percentage of net sales. The stores in this program average 19.6% of their top line revenue going to occupancy compared to 14.3% for the rest of the store fleet. Basically, this means that these stores pay a much higher percentage of their sales towards rent to the landlords than the other stores in the chain. This can be for a couple of different reasons. Maybe it's the rents being higher. Maybe it's the sales being lower at those stores. They do mention, though, that 60% of these stores have leases that expire or have kickouts over the next 3 years, which means they aren't looking to hastily close stores. But again, they're doing so when it makes the most financial sense so as not to break the lease agreements. And Leighton, you know, perhaps as much as anyone, that it is extraordinarily costly to break those lease agreements.
It absolutely is. And that's one thing that the managers do have to look at. And that is going to be a factor in those net present value figures that you mentioned of those stores that are being targeted. And of their portfolio, Maurice's has long targeted smaller markets, while Dress Barn, Catherine's, Lane Bryant, and Justice all targeted mid-sized markets. You look overall, Trent, their budget retail portion of their portfolio now makes up less than a third of overall sales, due in large part of sales cratering at Maurice's and Dress Barn. From their latest real estate portfolio page, Maurice's targets markets with as few as 25,000 people in a surrounding area. Similar brands performance, if you span this out and look at other operators in these smaller spaces, you're looking at Hibbett Sports, comp declines of 4.9% in their latest quarter. Cato Fashion, May same-store sales down 16%. Year-to-date same-store sales down 17%. And Stage Stores, comp declines of 9.6% in the latest quarter. So if you look at the bottom line, there's potentially going to be a lot of open real estate in smaller market retail centers, those C and D malls, even some B malls. For Ascena, though, this might be a good thing, perhaps easier to renegotiate those leases or looking at leases in other areas with small market sales trends. And you see that this is going to be a potential opportunity for them as they look to try to mitigate the cost of leases and try to increase their margins for the long term. But overall, I think the other problem at hand here is trying to bring more customers into their stores, their existing stores, that they look to remain open. We close our show's news portion with a sudden plunge at the largest U.S. brick-and-mortar toy retailer, that is Toys R Us. While private does report several statistics following each quarter, and we've talked about them in the past, we saw it was not a great sign for the toy giant here recently. In the past, we espoused their increased move towards the off-price space and their decent U.S. same-store sales. Obviously, they're trying to grow into some outlet malls and try to take advantage of those smaller footprint areas. All this despite still showing an operating loss, albeit a shrinking one. However, their first quarter of this fiscal year, released on June 13th, shows an operating loss increased from their first quarter a year ago from $126 million to $164 million. This was a direct result of sales declining 4.8% overall from the prior year's quarter, from $2.319 billion to $2.206 billion. The company noted several considerable softnesses in the baby category. Let's remember that the company isn't just made up of the Toys R Us, but freestanding Babies R Us stores as well. It could indeed be that their toy stores and off-price outlets are doing just fine. And if we look and dig a little deeper into the business overall, as a domestic percentage of sales, their baby category is down 48.8% last year to 46.7% this year. Most notable because they decided over the last decade to change many of their freestanding Toys R Us locations over to the Babies R Us locations. They were very bullish on this concept, Trent. They built this out throughout the United States, and even some locations near my market were switched over from successful Toys R Us locations. And I'd often wondered if those very large freestanding stores could sustain for the long term. Dave Brandon, their chairman and CEO, noted that the growth was slower in toys, meaning that there is at least still some growth out there in other areas potentially. Overall, same-store sales were down a whopping 4.1%, with U.S. stores plummeting 6.2%, but those international stores really boosted that number up to that 4% figure, with just a slight decline of 0.6%. Besides weaknesses in the baby categories, the company also blamed competitive pricing from competitors. And you see, both in terms of eroding their prices and in terms of luring customers away, obviously you have to keep those traffic counts up to remain competitive. However, basket size was down 0.4% in the U.S., meaning the loss of customers, 5.8% this quarter versus last year, was the bigger issue to talk about. Competitors in this case would be Walmart, Target, and Amazon. The prior two have openly talked about trying to remain competitive on price, and the CEO is correct in saying there is growth potential in certain areas. If you look at the market overall for U.S. baby products, it's said to be around $30 billion, or at least that's what it was in 2016, up 7% year over year, so obviously tripling GDP growth. However, Amazon is roughly 6.5% of that total $30 billion market, and they're up 20% over the last year. So not only are they growing at nearly three times the pace of the overall baby market, you seem to think that they are taking away traffic from Babies R Us. Amazon's growth can be seen in five primary categories, all of which Babies R Us pushes: feeding, car seats, activity and gear, care and safety, and furniture. All of those categories for Amazon were up over this past year.
And it's interesting that they're up, as we'll talk about in just a moment, because in terms of having children, the U.S. is kind of slowing down a little bit in fertility rate. Now, in terms of reasons for optimism or possible reasons for optimism from Toys R Us, they're still trying to funnel eggs into the baby basket by rolling out a revamped baby registry this summer. Now, if you look at another brick-and-mortar-based retailer in the same space, or at least in the space that Babies R Us occupies, Bye Bye Baby comes to mind. They have dominated this baby registry market in the past, fueled by what we consider an excellent registry system under the Bed Bath & Beyond banner. But I think going forward, despite the fact that baby products and the baby products market was said to be up year over year last year, some might question how wise it is to continue to look towards babies as an income source, since the U.S. birth rate fell in 2016 to its lowest levels since the CDC began tracking birth rate in 1909. Now, this won't necessarily impact 2016 baby sales, but it certainly will impact 2017 baby sales, as baby sales are often categorized through age 2 or 3. Baby sales, for that reason, much more volatile than something like toy sales. And they talked about growth slowing in toy sales, but there is still growth in toy sales at Toys R Us. Toys R Us, looking as a company, they have a smaller window for sales for their baby segment, ages 0 through 3, than their window for the toy segment, which ranges from about ages 2 through 14 or 15. Forbes also notes that the median household income boost of 5.2% in 2015 produced no boost in the birth rate as it had done for previous generations. What it does mean, though, is that when people do have children, they tend to spend a little bit more on kids, and that's what you're seeing from that prior number Layton suggested. But when you look at the data even deeper, I think we may begin over the next few years to see somewhat of a barbell effect in the numbers, or if you were to chart out the numbers, where some families have multiple children while others have none. The data is beginning to show a dichotomy where some families are having 2, 3, or 4 kids, whereas others are choosing to have none. You don't have a ton there in the middle. Right now, the average per household is around 1.86, which actually isn't enough to replenish the U.S. population. That number is supposed to be a little bit over 2. This would, in theory, going forward, hurt their baby segment even further, as families with multiple children are more likely to hand down baby clothes and toys, especially if they're having children of the same sex as the child they just previously had. Obviously, this wouldn't necessarily cross over. Maybe if you have a daughter and then you have a son, some families choose to buy different clothing, different toys for each one of those kids. Some families will, of course, still hand down clothes from one child to the next. So all of those are concerns about putting eggs in terms of the baby sales basket there at Toys R Us and Babies R Us. And maybe they would be more well advised to put some of the eggs in the electronics section or their basic toys section. Those are areas that not only are they seeing slight growth in, but you also see potential white space in those areas. One of the important things, though, for Toys R Us is that they are unveiling a newer e-commerce platform this summer. We've talked in the past about how their e-commerce platform has been somewhat jumbled to this point. They also want more store-in-store functions, and we've seen mixed results from other retailers in regard to store-in-store functions. For some, it works really well. For others, not so much. To this point, Toys R Us seems to be seeing success in their full-size stores from these store-in-store functions. They noted an enhanced loyalty program as well going forward. I think the most exciting things happening at Toys R Us is the revamp of the e-commerce platform and the additional store-in-store functions that they're installing. I'm not so sure how much an enhanced loyalty program will bring to the company, and I'm certainly not so sure how much initial baby rollouts and the rollout of a baby registry will help the company going forward. Looking at their balance sheet, it's still just okay, but they're starting to run out of space monetarily with which to work because they are losing money quarter after quarter. Cash and cash equivalents currently have $301 million, but that's down from $458 million a year ago. Nowhere near the cash on hand that they had 12 months ago. Total liquidity is also down from about $1 billion last year at this time to just $700 million now. So both liquidity and cash on hand taking a cut at Toys R Us, and they're beginning to run out of time to turn things around overall at the company.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, as we do every week, we close out the Retail Focus by taking a look ahead at stories we're keeping an eye on, and Leighton heads to the dollar segment for his.
This caught my eye, Trent, because I was looking up the recent share price of Dollar Tree, and there was a news story that you and I had both missed, and this was in regards to a potential expansion by Dollar Tree into Canada. And this is interesting because they're really trying to hedge against stagnation in the United States, but their stock price has really felt the effects of a strong competition in the dollar store market here domestically, but they have a 28% market share of the nearly $58 billion U.S. market here in terms of all those dollar stores that operate. And you talk about the acquisition of Family Dollar in 2015, you really do wonder, do they have much more room to grow throughout the United States? And so I think this is a very interesting idea here that Dollar Tree has put out, basically saying that they want to target over 1,000 stores in Canada over the next few years. They gave no specific timeline, but if you compare that to the number they have now there, the stores they operate, 226 in Canada, that's a fairly small number. And so if you look at the overall market opportunity there in Canada, it definitely exists. You see Dollarama, which is Canada's biggest dollar store concept, is approaching 1,100 locations. We spoke about them not too long ago, Trent, and their aspirations to have over 1,700 stores by 2027. And if you really compare that and contrast that with Dollar Tree's presence in over 14,400 locations in the United States, you can really see that they probably have the cash to kind of come in and take a little bit of business out of Dollarama's expectations for the future. But what's interesting is they are also facing a lawsuit that we were discussing here recently, alleging the improper spinoff that created Dollar Express. So a lot of interesting details, but if you look at their share price, which again is the whole reason why I stumbled upon this story, it is at a 52-week low, trading around $70 a share. So maybe this is something to really make shareholders excited about the future with Dollar Tree, as again, they have a 28% market share in the United States in terms of dollar stores.
I'm going to stay in the dollar segment and look towards Five Below. The ever-growing dollar segment store actually was downgraded by KeyBank Capital Markets, who told its clients that Five Below's fidget spinner sales are slowing, and as a result, that warranted a downgrade. Now, we're not sure if the folks at KeyBank Capital Markets are aware that Five Below actually sells a bunch of other merchandise besides fidget spinners, and also the fact that people are able to find fidget spinners at Five Below will create consumer habits where they continue to go back towards the slightly upscale dollar retailer. But nonetheless, they lowered their rating on Five Below to sector weight from overweight. So kind of an interesting thing. They mentioned that their channel checks indicate that sales have been decelerating in recent weeks, due in part because of the fact that fidget spinners are going out of style. Now, on that note, we still remain pretty bullish about Five Below's future, and we think that the fact that a lot of youths were finding fidget spinners at Five Below, purchasing them there, and choosing to purchase them there portends well for the retailer, as they were one of the first to cash in on the trend. They continue to remain sharply on trend in the dollar store segment, so I'm not sure that I completely buy into the rating, but I am anxious to see if Five Below directly references fidget spinners in their next quarterly release. That'll do it for us on the Retail Focus podcast. For Layton, I'm Trent. Quick note here is that we'll be at the shop.org conference September 25th through 27th. Coming up in just a few months, we'll have more information on our website and social media page about that. We'll be one of the anchors in the podcast booth they have there. Check out our Twitter account at Retail Podcast. And if you haven't done so already, subscribe to us on YouTube, where we'll be uploading one retail quick scan a week, which is an early week retail analytics segment when we can't get to something until later in the week on the podcast. One more thing, remember to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, any other podcast delivery service. And if you like us, be sure and rate us. We'll be back with you next week.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.